Good afternoon, fellow constitutionalists. Welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Dan Clements Show, a Christian political talk show. I'm your host, Dan Clements, your constitutional warrior, fighting for the right just to be an American. It is February 14th, the year of our Lord 2018. Remember, we're a hyphen-free, PC-free zone. God is still in control, and He does love you. And I'm broadcasting live from the Hemlock Studios here in the beautiful central Susquehanna Valley in the great Keystone State. And today, we got a really good show for you set up today. I'm going off an article that I saw on One American News Network talking about how a judge is ruling on the DACA program. He's the second federal judge to issue ruling blocking end of DACA program. Immigration debate continues. And this, again, is a One American News Network news item that is being put out. So, it amazes me how these judges, these liberal judges out there that are sitting on the federal bench, can make a ruling that actually upholds an unconstitutional executive order that was unconstitutional when it was written and issued, that should have been struck down. I think the only role the judges have, any judge, whether it's at the federal level or not, the only role that judge has is to determine whether DACA is constitutional or not. Not to uphold something that's unconstitutional, because if I remember right, they take an oath to uphold and preserve the Constitution of the United States, not that they're supposed to uphold something that's unconstitutional. And again, I don't get it. As one of my truck drivers used to say, Lewis, he says, I don't get it, Big Dan. I don't get it either. How can a sitting judge uphold something that's unconstitutional to begin with? I keep going around in circles here, and it bogs my imagination, folks. It really does. And this is one of the reasons why I'm live broadcasting this, among others. I just felt I'd rather live broadcast this, maybe get some more participation in the chat room while I'm doing this. So let's get into the show here while we're getting started. Today's show is being brought to you by one of my affiliate marketers, Bluehost. Now, Bluehost is a web hosting. You can get your domains through there. And what's fantastic about Bluehost is they're WordPress ready. You get a free domain through them when you hook up to the service. You get free site builders. You have one-click WordPress install, which is very, very important. There are web services, and I have used them in the past, like Squarespace, that you don't do anything. You just tell them what you want to do, and it'll do it. And they take care of everything. If you want a little more control, I suggest Bluehost. I've been in the past where I've used a platform called Joomla, where I was in total control of the website. And that takes some knowledge and it takes a steep learning curve. And Bluehost and WordPress are the perfect spot for you if you want some control over your website, but not where you have to go in and know a little bit about coding and stuff like that. And their prices are fantastic. Right now they're running a $3.95 a month special to start off with. Can't beat it, folks. You just can't beat it. And the service level with these folks and as far as I'm concerned, anybody that they've associated themselves with, like the WordPress plugins that they didn't come up with, but they're third party, fantastic customer service, folks. And I never asked them, but it seems to me that they vet these folks to make sure that if they're going to come on their platform with their WordPress plugins, that they're going to work. And if they don't, they have customer service to help the customers out. I can't say enough about these folks. I really, really can't. So if you're looking for reasonably priced web hosting service, easy to install themes and plugins to get your website up and running, and you have more control over it, I highly, highly recommend my marketing affiliate marketer, Bluehost, to actually do that. All right, today's daily Bible reading comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 8 through 11. Then last of all, he was seen by me also, and this is the Apostle Paul talking to the Corinthians here, as by one born out of due time, for I am the least of the apostles, who am not worthy to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God, I am what I am. And his grace towards me was not in vain, but I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God which was with me. Therefore, whether it was I or they, so we preach, and so you believed. So Paul felt very passionate about his conversion, about the grace of God saving him. He was totally, totally passionate about this and really understood what that meant, to be in God's good graces, folks. Today's quote mail comes from Bob Benson. When life caves in, you do not need reasons. You need comfort. You do not need some answers. You need someone. And Jesus did not come to us with an explanation. He comes to us with his presence. And folks, this really strikes at a heart of a matter that me and my wife dealt with my daughter. You know, there was no reason why what happened to my daughter happened to her. And we were seeking answers, but they take time. And if it wasn't for me and my wife co-comforting each other and the prayers and the friendship and the comfort that we experienced from the brethren at the church, I don't know how we'd have made it through it. I don't know how we'd have made it through without that relationship we have with Jesus Christ and God through his church, through his word. So, you know, that this one, I really like this one. It really strikes, sort of pulls at my heart, as it were. Short Bible lesson today, and this is something I saw, and this is a question that's being asked. I was involved in a little bit of a mini debate on Facebook about the different versions of the Bible, and I was being taken to task because I said that the King James Version Bible was based on the Latin Vulgate and the Greek Septuagint, and I was told, no, it wasn't. It was based on the Textus Receptus, and if you go back and read about what the King James Version of the Bible was based on, I was right. You just have to go through a couple layers to get there. And I'm watching some videos on this that he suggested I watch that's going to try to convince me that the King James Version is the only version we should be using. And that's erroneous because some of the newer versions, like the New American Standard Version, the New Revised Standard Version, all rely on manuscripts that are far older than the ones relied upon by the King James Version, which brings out more accuracies. So I don't want to get into that debate now, but I think it's important to understand, when was the church established? And this is by Foy Forehand over gewatkins.net, and it's a sermon outline. And I use a lot of these sermon outlines like a study outline for myself. I go through and study some of these things out that I have questions about, and they're chock full of explanations and scriptures and stuff like that. So I encourage you, if you have a question about when was the church established, was it established around 600 AD as the Roman Catholics claim it was? Was it established around the Protestant Reformation about 1,500 years later or 1,000 years later? You know, when was the church established? We need to actually answer that. We need to answer that biblically, not by what man says. All right. Now let's get to the heart of the show here, folks. This is, again, this is fantastic to me. It really is. That we have a sitting federal judge. And this is the second one, folks. This isn't the first one. This is actually the second judge. Issues ruling blocking end of DACA program, immigration debate continues. And this is one American News Room article updated about 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. today, excuse me. That was specific time. A second federal judge issued a ruling temporarily blocking the DACA program from ending. On Tuesday, a New York-based district judge ruled the Obama-era program could not be rescinded pending a decision on the merits of these cases. He also called on the federal government to continue to process DACA applications. Tuesday's ruling follows a similar decision last month by a San Francisco-based district judge. Following that decision, the Trump administration called on the Supreme Court to review the case. The White House has set a March 5th deadline to solve the DACA issue. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans are already facing an uphill battle over immigration as a day of debate turned into a day of mudslinging. Open-ended discussion kicked off on the floor of the upper chamber Tuesday with party leaders arguing over how to begin. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell tried to set up a vote on a sanctuary city amendment on two different occasions, but it was immediately shot down by the top Democrat, Chuck Schumer, who argued DACA and border security were not addressed. This comes as President Trump warned, it's now or never for DACA. Now, let me unpack this a little bit. And I started to talk about this in my monologue here for the show. We have the second federal judge ruling on an unconstitutional executive order issued by President Barack Obama, which created law. According to the Constitution, legislative power is not vested in the executive branch. It's only vested in Congress, period. If you go to your, if you got your little, like I said, I use a PDF, I printed out a PDF, New Testament, PDF Constitution. It says here, Article 1, Section 1, legislative branch, the legislature. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in the Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. Now, if all legislative power herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, that doesn't leave any legislative power for any other branches, including the judiciary and especially the executive branch. So what happened when President Barack Obama issued an executive order creating DACA, okay? It was because Congress was not willing to move on it. They couldn't get a bill passed through Congress, so he has a pen and a phone, issued an executive order, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, and it's become law. Wrong. Now, Obama supporters would have you believe, the liberals and the regressives and the progressives over in the Democrat Party would have you believe that since President Barack Obama issued this from on high, that it is law. But again, the president cannot use an executive order to create law because the president of the United States does not have that delegated authority according to the Constitution of the United States. So we have an unconstitutional executive order to begin with. We have the second federal judge ruling the blocking the end of the DACA program. What their rulings should have been, both of these judges, and I believe this amounts to bad behavior on their part because they're not living up to their oaths of office to uphold the Constitution of the United States. Both of these judges, or at least the first judge in San Francisco, you know they're not going to do it, but at least the first judge in San Francisco should have said, we can't go any further with this because it was an unconstitutional executive order that created this. Therefore, we can't rule to block the ending of this DACA. All we can rule on is if this order was constitutional or not, and they should have come to the conclusion that it was unconstitutional or not. Now, if they didn't come to that conclusion, if it was unconstitutional or not, then that would have been kicked up through the process to up to and including the Supreme Court, which would assuredly, if these justices and the Supreme Court were worth anything, they would have to rule the executive orders unconstitutional. Now, I've had a lot of backlash because of this. There has been a lot of people that have been commenting on this. There has been a lot of people who think that I'm just totally off my rocker, that I don't have a degree in constitutional studies, therefore I don't know what I'm talking about. And again, I printed this out. It's you can get the Constitution in PDF, and the wonderful thing about Adobe Reader is that you can print this out in book form. And I went to a double-sided printer that a friend of mine has and printed this out in book form, stapled this together, and it's great. It's got wide margins in it, so if I want to make notes, which I don't, but if I want to make notes on or something like that, I can. And if it gets too written up or too dirty, I can go do it again. I can print this out again because it gives you the whole Constitution plus the Bill of Rights. The only thing it doesn't have in it is the Declaration of Independence, and I have that elsewhere. And one of these days, I'm going to print both of them together. I'm going to put them together in a little booklet like this. But this is not hard to understand. It's not hard to read. You do not have to have a law degree to understand this and apply this at all. So I'm just amazed that this whole hoopla, this brouhaha, this argy-bargy is going on with these two judges and DACA when DACA is an unconstitutional program to begin with. I just have to wonder where our republic is heading because of judges like this. We're quickly becoming a banana republic is what we are with rulings like this. Blocking the end of an unconstitutional program instead of upholding the Constitution to begin with. It boggles my mind. Now, one of the problems with DACA, or DACA, however you want to pronounce this, and I was trying to get this larger, and I can go a little bit. Let me get over here. So you might be able to see it a little bit better. Knows no other country. Now, this is by Mark Kerkorian over at the Center for Immigration Studies. And this was posted on February 13th. Senator Grassley and several Republican colleagues have unveiled legislation modeled on the White House immigration framework. It is expected to be offered as an amendment, perhaps as early as today, to the shell bill that Mitch McConnell has put forth as the Senate vehicle for immigration. The fact sheet describing the bill's high points lists criteria to qualify for amnesty, including arrival in the United States before age 16. It adds some standards used by the Obama administration for DACA, or same standards, excuse me. As I asked in my piece in National Review yesterday, and this would have been on the 12th, why would an expansion of the amnesty beyond those who already have DACA work permits be based on the same criteria as Obama's unlawful program itself modeled on a bill Dick Durbin wrote in 2001? Most important, why should the age cutoff be as high as 16? As I wrote back in 2010, the point is to provide amnesty for those whose identity was formed here, then you need a much lower age cutoff. I have a 15-year-old, and if I took him to live illegally in Mexico and live illegally is a lot harder to do than it is here, he would always remain psychologically an American because his identity is already formed. The Roman Catholic Church and English common law set up the age of reason at 7. That, combined with a requirement of at least 10 years continuous residence here, seems like a much more defensible place to draw the line. Neither the White House Grassley bill nor any of the other DACA plus amnesty plans offers any justification for including people who came as teenagers in an amnesty intended for people who know no other country. And this has been one of the arguments about the DACA program. Oh, we can't send these kids, these poor kids back. We cannot send them back to their countries of origin because they know no other country. Well, if you grew up, again, age of reason, 7 years old, I depended on the children and the gender, male or female, I placed it between 7 and 13, somewhere in that area about maturity and knowing and stuff like that. But still, if a 16-year-old comes over here and was brought over here illegally by his parents, that 16-year-old does know another country. And that's the issue here. And this is what happens when the lamestream media and progressive Democrats want to cloud the issue. Is they throw this up, oh, they know no other country. And without any research whatsoever, people just, yeah, you know what? That makes sense. They don't know another country. Why would we be heartless to send them back? Well, we're not being heartless by sending them back at all. We're sending them back to a country they absolutely do know. I known some teenagers in the past that came from other countries, and they, most of them that I know of, they're brought here legally, and yet they knew English, but English was not their first language. And if you talk to them, they said they did miss their country of origin to a certain extent, but they loved the United States and the freedoms they had here. So the kids do know. So don't fall for this argument about knows no other country. It's ridiculous, and it doesn't make any sense, especially depending on how old they are. If they're and I'll keep the 7 years old because it's a good cutoff. If they're over 7 years old, they did know another country, and I bet you they could fit right back into that country without with little problem, or very few problems, as I should say. All right, now what's... Again, the Senate's working on their own bill, okay, and we'll get into that here in the next couple of things, but the House is actually putting together a bill also. It's called H.R. 4760, Secure America's Futures Act, and this is a bill summary by R.J. Heyman on February 9th of this year. The background, a group of House Republicans led by Judiciary Chairman Bob Goodlatte, Republican Virginia, and Homeland Security Chairman Michael McCaul, Republican Texas, introduced the Securing America's Future Act to overhaul the nation's immigration system. In addition to making structural reforms and strengthening immigration enforcement, the bill gives a limited amnesty to illegal aliens, beneficiary of President Obama's Deferred Action of Childhood Arrivals, or the DACA program. To date, the bill represents the most serious proposal to address the future of approximately 700,000 illegal aliens who enrolled in DACA. The summary: the Securing America's Future Act takes a comprehensive approach to immigration reform that includes common sense provisions that ensure the public's national security and economic interest are prioritized. The bill includes provisions that protect American jobs, preserve public safety and national security, and reform admissions priorities to reflect a fair, more sustainable, and safe legal immigration system. Although the bill grants amnesty to those illegal aliens granted deferred action through President Obama's unlawful DACA program, it provides counterbalancing provisions to mitigate the inevitable consequences of an amnesty. And I'm going to stop reading there. Now, what has happened in past amnesties, they passed these amnesties, and it was like the floodgates were open to come into the country because they didn't secure the borders. And the one thing we'll read on down through here, the one thing that we definitely need, and I don't think the Senate's even talking about, at least the Democrats in the Senate don't want to even talk about it, and this is going to be very hard to reconcile any bills coming between the two of them, is the fact that this bill, and any bill that the American people are going to accept and President Trump's going to sign, has to have border security, and that means a border wall. And we'll see later on, I got some other articles are going to share how much it costs to resettle just the refugees in this country. Not all the welfare that illegal immigrants and some legal immigrants get when they get here, okay? What does Securing America's Future Act do? Prioritizes merit-based immigration, ends extended chain migration. The bill limits family-based immigration admissions to the nuclear family or to the spouse and minor children of immigrants. Current law allows adult immigrants to petition distant relatives for green cards with no regard to an individual's education, language skill, or capacity to contribute to the American economy. Ends the visa lottery. Today, the visa lottery allocates 50,000 visas annually to applicants at random and without consideration for an applicant's ability to succeed in the United States or their ties to this country. The Securing America's Future Act reorients the system to one that favors skilled employment-based visa categories. So they're gonna end the lottery for it. Now it's a merit-based lottery instead of a visa just, you know, passing them out like lottery cards, you know, at Christmas time, right? Lottery tickets. Increase immigration levels for skilled workers while reducing overall immigration levels. And they talk about some things in there. Creates new agricultural guest worker program. The bill replaces the existing H-2A program with one that enables agricultural employers to fill demonstrated seasonal labor shortages, establishes a renewable non-immigrant visa for parents of U.S. citizens. The bill allows parents of United States citizens to obtain a non-immigrant visa at no cost to taxpayers. Secures our borders, authorizes border wall construction. The bill authorizes but does not appropriate funding for a border wall. Improves border security, implements a biometric entry exit system. This bill requires full implementation of a biometric entry exit system at all points of entry and makes technological advances and infrastructure improvement in order to keep the border secured. Prevents future illegal immigration, requires all employees to use E-Verify. If you don't know what that is, please look it up. DuckDuckGoIt. That's my search engine of choice. Increases penalties for employers who violate laws that protect American workers. Cracks down on sanctuary cities. This is huge here. This bill grants authorization to the Justice Department to withhold law enforcement grants from uncooperative jurisdictions and creates a legal cause of action so victims of illegal alien crimes may sue the cities that release their attackers. Increases cooperation with the state and local law enforcement. Penalizes repeat criminal offenders. Closes a loophole in current law that sustains illegal border surges. Cracks down on visa overstays. And this is far and away one of the worst abuses in our immigration system is these folks that come over on visas, 3 month or 6 month or whatever, student visa for the time they're going to college, and then they never go home. They never ever go home. And that's a huge problem. And the thing is, this has to be one of the easiest ones to actually enforce. We should know where these people are at all times. It's not rocket science. You know, it's not like SpaceX to launch a car up in space. It's not that hard. Gives amnesty to DACA recipients. Creates a renewable legal status for DACA beneficiaries. Allows only individuals who received deferred action under President Obama's DACA program, approximately 694,000, to get a three-year renewable legal status permitting them to live, travel, and work in the United States legally. Prohibits criminals from receiving amnesty. Contains no special path to a green card. Beneficiaries may renew their legal status at the end of its term or make use of an existing path to a green card if appropriate. Now, this is from the Foundation for American Immigration Reform. Now, FAIR applauds Representative Goodlatte, McCall, Labrador, and McSally for bringing many important provisions to restore the integrity of our immigration system to the forefront of the national debate with the Securing America's Future Act. Specifically, the bill's targets dangerous sanctuary cities, enhances border security, mandates E-Verify, eliminates the visa lottery, and perhaps most importantly, ends chain migration, which has depressed wages and displaced American workers for generations. The bill also extends the protections afforded to the DACA illegal alien population, something President Trump has expressed a willingness to do. FAIR opposes amnesty in any form, including extending DACA protections. FAIR does, however, heartily supports the elements of the Securing America's Future Act. I dare anybody say that 10 times fast. Specifically representing long overdue reforms that protect American workers, support the integrity of the immigration system, and preserve public safety. Those are important imperatives on which Congress must act. So everything except for the border wall, which they approve, but they don't give money to, which is kind of dumb. But again, it's a start. It's far better than what the Senate's actually trying to propose right now. Now, FAIR also put up this call to action. Tell the Senate to focus on fixing our immigration problems, not amnesty. And this is just a call to action. I'm going down to the background of this. On Monday, the Senate voted to begin floor debate on proposals to give amnesty to at least 1.8 million illegal aliens, a number far greater than the existing DACA population. And I was reading some articles about this. It's not only the children, it's the adults of the children too. So, and the parents, which they're the ones that broke the law to begin with, but I'm not going to dwell on that. Then open debate is the fulfillment of a promise made by Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, as part of the efforts to end the government shutdown last month. One thing already is clear this week. Senators in both parties are dead set on ramming through a mass amnesty bill while giving the American people little to nothing in return. We need to put their heads on straight. What about securing our borders, protecting American jobs, ending chain migration, and stopping dangerous sanctuary cities? These are the priorities of the American people, not amnesty. So if a bill comes out of the Senate does not address what's in H.R. 4760, I think it's dead on arrival in the House. I really do. I don't think it's going to get anywhere. Now, will H.R. 4760 get anywhere in the Senate? I don't know. If it's overwhelmingly supported in the House and voted on that way, I think folks have a reasonable expectation. I say a reasonable expectation. They have a reasonable expectation of the Senate to follow suit and get this thing passed. But only time will tell. And I believe that the Democrats are going to be the roadblock in this. I really do, because all they want is amnesty. They don't want anything else. Anything else would block potential future voters for the Democrats. If they start securing the borders and start keeping people out of the country that aren't supposed to be here or overstaying their welcome on visas, this is just, it's the Senate bill will be a mess. And I don't think they would have enough oomph in the Senate if the House did pass it to override a veto. But if something like the Senate bill, and we'll get into this right now, it's called the Skinny Immigration Plan. And this has been gaining traction in the Senate. And this is by Susan Fairchild over the Washington Examiner, and it's gaining traction. Now, again, this is one of these bills that if this passes, I don't think it's going to get past the House. And if it would get past the House, if President Trump signed it, then honestly, I think he's going to have some supporters turn on him, because this is one of the keystones of his election, of his platform, you know, to become president, was immigration reform. And skinny immigration reform ain't going to get it. It's not going to get it done. Now, here's what the skinny version of immigration reform with language that scaled back from President Trump's preferred bill is emerging as the only measure that could possibly win enough votes to pass the Senate, which was still struggling on Tuesday to find a consensus. Republicans and Democrats said Tuesday that a plan that pairs legal protection for so-called Dreamers with significant border security funding might have the momentum to win 60 votes in the Senate. Now, let me stop reading. They are talking about securing the borders and funding it, but that's the only thing they're talking about besides the Dreamers. Such a bill would exclude reforms sought by Trump to end chain migration, the visa lottery system, issues that have been divided and that have divided two parties and have made it impossible to find agreement. While the bill would only include two of Trump's four pillars, lawmakers said the truncated plan would provide the only viable pathway to an accord ahead of the March 5th deadline Trump has set for Congress to replace the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. It might be a two-pillar bill instead of a four-pillar bill, said Senator Lindsey Graham, the great liberal of the Republican Party. He said Tuesday after meeting with Republican lawmakers in a closed-door meeting. Supporters of the idea are hoping it can unclog a Senate that stumbled out of the gate Tuesday when Democrats twice blocked a Republican motion to open the immigration debate with a vote on legislation that would withhold some federal funding from so-called sanctuary cities. The stalling tactic will limit how much time Republicans and Democrats have to debate various immigration reform proposals this week. Republicans only set aside this week for floor work on immigration, which means the clock is ticking to find a proposal that can pass. Graham acknowledged that the four-pillar proposal by the Trump administration, while divisive, is a serious offer that has moved the Republican Party a long way on immigration. It would provide a pathway to citizenship for 1.8 million young people who came to the United States illegally as children in exchange for $25 million in border security funding and new limits to chain migration. The proposal would also end the visa lottery system. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky, backs the Trump plan, which has been introduced in the Senate by Senator Tom Cotton, Republican Arkansas, David Perdue, Republican Georgia, among others. But Graham said he doubts the bill could win 60 votes because the vast majority of Democrats oppose it. The provision to limit change migration, which Democrats call family reunification, is the main sticking point, Graham said. Democrats oppose the bill plan to limit chain migration to nuclear families comprised of minor children and spouses. I'm for going to nuclear family for change migration, Graham said. I just think you're not going to get that in exchange for the DACA population. And again, I'm going to stop reading there. This is what frustrates me about politics. Oh, it's all about the compromise. Folks, you cannot compromise on principles. And either you have them or you don't. And if you don't, what are you doing there? Are you just pulling a paycheck and getting some money from lobbyists to line your pockets with? If that's all it is, get out of there. Get out of there. Many Democrats Tuesday called for a limited immigration reform bill. We continue to believe a narrow proposal has the best chance of passing the Senate and the best chances to being signed into the law, Senate Majority or Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat in New York, said Tuesday after meeting with the party lawmakers privately. There's no way a skinny bill like this, a skinny immigration plan, is going to pass the House of Representatives. These guys act like if it passes the Senate, it's going to go right on up to the president. I'm telling you now, they don't have the votes in the House for a skinny immigration bill. They just don't. In the House, they're working on the four-pillar plan. I don't think they go far enough. I think they need to fully fund the border wall as far as building it. And I think they need to do a couple other things in there, but in the basics of it are good. The basics of H.R. 4760 are pretty good. But again, you're not going to get the Democrats to side with you, and you're not going to get the House to go with the skinny immigration. And again, I don't think 4760 will make it through the Senate either, but at least if that passes the House and it goes to the Senate, then you're going to have something you're going to take into the midterm elections. That these Democrats are the ones that are throwing up roadblock to meaningful immigration reform. And I think the Republicans have the majority of the American people on their side on this issue. For far too long, at least my whole life, I was born in 1962, shortly after Eisenhower did the first one that I remember, amnesty, and it didn't work. And we've had so many since then that didn't work. Why? Because it didn't secure the border. It did not secure the border the way it needed to be secured. Now, I'm going to get into two more articles here, and this is part of the problem too, which I don't think, my personal opinion, the federal government can, and I think in Article 2, Section 8, has the authority as far as the immigration and naturalization. Let me read this. To establish the uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States, so they can establish a uniform rule of naturalization. And I have libertarian friends that says, well, that doesn't authorize federal government to do anything at the borders or do anything at immigration. I said, you got to be kidding me, right? I said, all you got to do is go back and read what the founding fathers are thinking about this. In order to have naturalization, you have to have immigration. If you don't have naturalization, that means you don't have immigration. And if you don't have immigration coming to the country, you don't have to worry about naturalization. But they keep saying, no, 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 that's just for naturalization. They have no authority. I do believe Article 1, Section 2, or Section 8, Article 1, Section 8, the powers of Congress absolutely clearly gives them authority over immigration. However, I do not believe that authority extends to refugee entitlements. States' rights versus refugee entitlements. I do not think the federal government has the authority to relocate refugees anywhere they want in the United States. I really don't. And I think states can constitutionally refuse to allow the federal government to do so. Now, if the federal government has empty military bases that they've evacuated and haven't sold and still under their control, I believe the federal government can use those as refugee camps, but they have to contain the refugees upon those bases, cannot allow them to get out in general public. Matter of fact, I have an article here that we'll get into next before we end the show, talking about a study that was done by FAIR, FAIRUS.org, that's the Foundation for American Immigration Reform. Resettling refugees cost the U.S. $1.8 billion annually. Now, I've read other stories talking about this plus the welfare that illegal and legal immigrants take from our treasury, as it were, is closer to $90 billion a year, almost $100 billion a year. We're told you can build the wall for less than that. That's what we're told. I don't know if that's true, but that's what we're told. But I don't think, and there's a court test going on here, and this article's by Bob Dane over at immigrationreform.com. Can states just say no to foreign refugees? Tennessee is testing the proposition in federal court. Tennessee versus U.S. Department of State, in a case every state and taxpayer should watch closely in light of the new FAIR research showing per capita refugee cost running nearly $80,000 over 5 years. Like other states, Tennessee experienced a surge in refugee arrivals during the Obama administration with attendant increases in social services cost to the state and its localities. The FAIR study does not break down the cost by state, nor does it incorporate all the expenses incurred by them, so the $80,000 price tag is necessarily a lowball figure. Tennessee argues a larger point, the U.S. Constitution does not endow the federal government with unbridled power to direct state spending or interfere with the state's control over its own budget. Richard Thompson, attorney with the nonpartisan Thomas More Law Center, asserts the federal government's commandeered state funds to operate a federal program. In doing so, Tennessee lost its ability to control its own budget and was deprived of its sovereignty under the 10th Amendment. Partial relief is expected as the Trump administration reduces the number of refugees allowed into the country, but reductions in federal refugee assistance over the past two decades have pushed more cost into the state and local governments. Unlike immigrants who are expected to be self-sufficient from the moment they arrive here, refugee resettlement is a humanitarian policy, and we expect that there will be fiscal costs. These significant costs limit the number of people who can be resettled and force us to consider how we can use limited resources to protect the greatest number of people. Refugees are eligible for a broad range of the state-based welfare benefits, including housing assistance for as long as they reside in the United States, education expenses fueled by cost-intensive English language learner and special ed programs are funded primarily by state and local taxpayers. Meantime, refugees pay only a fraction of their cost. FAIR estimates the average state and local income tax contribution per working refugee at barely $4,200 over 5 years. One in six adult refugees declares no income. The volunteer state tried to get out of this lopsided arrangement in 2007. Washington responded by threatening to withhold federal medical funding, 20% of the state's budget. Then the U.S. State Department prioritized the refugee program, allowing Catholic charities to circumvent state and local authorities in Tennessee. The federal government nullified the decision of the people of Tennessee to withdraw from the ostensibly voluntary federal program and thereby commandeered state funds to support a federal initiative, the Tennessee lawsuit argues. Tennessee is asking a federal court to rein in federal power and uphold what's left of the 10th Amendment. Failing that, President Trump could revoke the Clinton-era order, 45 CFR 400.301, that empowers resettlement contractors like Catholic Charities to continue operations in the state that opt out of the refugee program. States are supposed to be consulted on refugee resettlement matters for a reason. It's time for the federal government to listen to their voices. And again, this whole immigration thing brings up 10th Amendment issues, especially with refugees, brings up 10th Amendment issues that need to be addressed. And I I can't tell you how this is going to go. I hope it goes in favor of Tennessee, because I do believe that this is an unconstitutional move on the federal government, because refugees are different than immigrants. And refugees should only be a temporary fix. And matter of fact, I've said this on previous shows before several different times, that it would be cheaper and easier on the refugees if we sought refugee camps closer to their home countries, where their languages are similar or the same, the climate is similar or the same. It would cost us way less money to do that than to bring them over here. And then once the conflict, war zone, whatever is done in that country, then they can go back to their homes and try to rebuild like they're doing in Iraq right now, especially in Mosul. That would be easier on the refugees. But no, we got to bring them over to the United States and put them at a disadvantage to begin with, put a burden on state budgets, which a lot of states are hurting because of pension programs and stuff like that. And these are unfunded mandates by the federal government. And again, I don't think the naturalization clause in Article 1, Section 8 covers refugees. I really don't. I do believe, because these refugees, I don't think they're going to become citizens anytime soon. Matter of fact, I think once the conflicts are over and people start to move back into their home countries, I think we need to ship these refugees back. And if they want to come over here, let them go through the right process to get here. Honestly. And folks, and I know this is hard, and I know I'm going to say something that's going to really make a lot of people mad, but I think us taking in refugees from country is not doing the refugees any favors, and is not doing the home country any favors. Mexico, we allow all this illegal immigration across the border, and it's a relief valve for the Mexican government, so they don't have to deal with all the problems that the, you know, the folks that are trying to escape. That, and I don't even call Mexico a first world country yet, maybe a second world, but not a first world country. And it's closer to a third world country with the drug cartels and all the lawlessness and the corruption down there. And I'm not saying we don't have corruption in the United States. Lord knows we have more than our share of corruption up here. But do we need to be importing it? And do we need to be a relief valve for Mexico? Do we need to be a relief valve for Cuba? Do we need to be a relief valve for Haiti? No. And I think, do we need to help these folks in place? Yes. Do some of these governments need to be changed? Yes. Should we go in and change them for the people? No. I think we need to educate these folks. I think we need to educate these folks on how to govern themselves. Give them some basics in government 101. I mean, folks, you don't have to look very far, and I don't want to get too far off the subject here, but look at South Africa. They're killing white farmers by the dozens. And that country is slowly slipping. I mean, it's already reverted back to a third world country. Everything, and I never agreed with apartheid, so don't get me wrong here, but all the advances under apartheid with the economy and infrastructure and stuff like that, that were basically given to them, when apartheid was done, and the native folks, and you can't call the Dutch farmers not native, especially if they've been living there for generations, okay? But the black nationalists over there in South Africa have taken over the government, and they have done nothing to preserve what was given to them or what they took over. As a matter of fact, it's actually regressed. And it's a shame what's going on over there. But should we start taking... Now, if some of these farmers and people that are facing genocide over there, I think we need to get them out of that country. But shouldn't they go back to countries of origin? You know, their families may have came from the United States, might have relatives here or Europe somewhere or Sweden, you know, wherever they came from, if they want to leave the country. But I think again, that would be a refugee status. And if they wanted to go back, and they should go back after the country was stabilized and things started going on the mend, then they should be allowed to go back. And so, I don't think resettling them over here in the United States would be the best thing. I think trying to resettle them as close as possible to their home country, or actually go in and set up a protective zone in that country where, let's face it, the white farmers especially and white business owners down there are being slaughtered. Then at least they can go somewhere and they can be protected from that. Is it a perfect solution? No, it's not. Is it a perfect solution to bring the refugees over here? No. Is it a better solution? Maybe not perfect, but is it a better solution to have the refugees stay as close to their country as possible so when things get better and normalized in their country, they can go back and start their lives over again? It's just, again, what's fair to the United States? What's in our best interest to do? And we do need to be compassionate about it, but we also need to be realistic about it too. We really do. Now, this study, I'm not going to go through the whole thing. This was posted on February 5th of this year. New fair study, resettling refugees cost the U.S. about $1.8 billion. In the last article, we said that may be a little bit on the low side. It's probably, I've read articles where it's probably closer to $3 to $4 billion a year. Depending on the help that each one of them get. And again, this is one of those studies that that you really, I don't want to be insensitive to this, but this is one of these studies that they don't get all the figures right. And again, I want to go to another issue that I've dealt with on the show, and we're going to deal with it in the near future here on this show, is net neutrality. Their folks are still saying that investment didn't go down while net neutrality was the law of the land, even though it was forced into being and making the internet a Title II. And when you start digging into the numbers, which the pro-net neutrality folks say, well, the groups that you're citing are right-wing groups and you can't trust them, yet they go through and break down the numbers like, real quick here, like AT&T... they're adding in their spending money on the acquisition of DirecTV, which is a satellite company that does not have internet, and opening up or buying a wireless place in Mexico, which has nothing to do with broadband in the United States. So these conservative economists took those figures out of what the pro-net neutrality folks want to figure into the spending to make their argument look better. And when you take out all that extra spending that has nothing to do with broadband, you'll see that, again, the figures don't add up. And just like this FAIR study, they don't have all the information in there. They're taking their best guess on the information that they have. I'm not saying they're guessing about it, but they're taking their best guess on the information that they have. And so, again, we really, really need to sit down and figure this out. When it comes to issues like this, when it comes to immigration, when it comes to other things that we're trying to do here, and I got to get I didn't get my speaker set up here. When we're trying to do other things, especially with immigration, we got to get this right. We can't go on doing the same things over and over again, expecting different results. We can't do that. And so I like H.R. 4760, but I don't think it's going to pass Congress or pass the Senate. And the skinny immigration bill the Senate's doing is they're wasting their time. And they're wasting and putting upon the American people's patience to get this right. So call your representative, call the Senate, tell them to do the four pillars and then some. To try to fix this immigration issue once and for all, so we're not kicking the issue down the road like the Democrats want, just like the Republicans in their budget funded Planned Parenthood. So much for them being pro-life. Okay, this has been the Dan Clements Show. I'm your host, Dan Clements. Your Constitution, warrior fighting for the right just to be an American. Remember, if you aim at nothing, you hit it every time. Have a great rest of the day, and God bless, and we'll see you on the next video.